Onwards. So we're going to move to the integumentary system. There we go. So of course, like all the other sections, we have to do normal first, a bit of a review of the normal integumentary system, just as a reminder for all of you. So it's this thing right here. Those are kind of braid, eh? Is there a way to kind of cut that edge off a bit? What update did I give you into? Yes. I'm sorry? Yeah, what did I do? Oh, okay. My spelling mistakes are because I can't type. I am a three-finger typer. And I tend to, my fingers wander and do all sorts of weird things. Oh, okay. So, we know the skin is made up of two areas. A more apical epidermis, a deeper dermis. The epidermis is the outermost, and of course it is epithelial cells. Does anybody remember what kind of epithelial cells we find in the dermis? Epidermis, sorry. What's the epidermis made up of? Yeah, what kind of epithelial cells? So if it's a single layer, we call it... What do we call it if it's just one layer of cells? Simple. What do we call it if it's many layers of cells? Guys have forgotten already? Come on. Look it up. So, it is squamous cells, many layers of it. The dermis makes up the bulk of the skin. It's the leathery part, and it's composed of fibrous tissue. Only the dermis is vascularized, so the epidermis is not, right? The epidermis in its more basal layers, of course, does take from through osmosis, does take nourishment from the dermal layer. Nutrients reach the epidermis only through diffusion from the dermal layer. Subcutaneous tissue just deep to the skin is called the hypodermis or superficial fascia. This is not considered to be part of the skin. It is underneath. And that subcutaneous tissue is adipose plus some areolar tissue, which you remember is a type of what kind of tissue? Adipose and areolar are what kind of tissue? What family do they belong in? Correct. Connective tissue. Well done. Okay. The superficial fascia anchors the skin to the underlying structures, but it also allows the skin to be able to slide and move and do the things that it does. We will be talking about a couple. We did talk a little bit about scleroderma there in terms of connective tissue, kind of autoimmune disorder, which causes the skin to harden and therefore hasn't got this slippy, slidey type of configuration, and of course range of motion diminishes immensely for the patient. The superficial fascia also acts as an insulator and shock absorber, and when we gain weight, is the superficial fascia generally that gets thickened. The epidermis is a thick and heavily keratinized epithelial tissue. There are four cell types in here. There are keratinocytes that are responsible for. Yeah, what do keratinocytes produce? Keratin. Because what happens to the most apical cells in the epidermis? They start alive and then they die because they are full of keratin. Okay? That's where it comes from. Melanocytes, what are they responsible for? So pigmentation, great. And Langerhans cells and Merkel cells. I told you all this stuff would come back to haunt you. Langerhans cells and Merkel cells, what are they responsible for? There is an easy answer. No. Is it in the skin? all you have to say is, Brian, those are nerve sensory cells. Okay? Okay? Yes. So there's a keratinocyte, of course, responsible for the color of skin. Epidermis, the keratinocyte, the deeper layer is the basal layer, and the cells found here are almost constant in constant mitosis, right? So we're always growing from the basal layer to the apical layer. So as we slough off skin at the most apical layer, it's constantly being replaced by cells that are going from the basal deep layer to the superficial layer. The newly created cells push the mature keratin cells up towards the surface, and as these cells move superficially, they make the keratin, which eventually fills the cell contents, so that by the time they get to the top, they are dead, and they are nothing more than a cell membrane full of keratin. Remember, keratin is what allows for waterproofing, and also adds the abrasion, able to deal with the abrasion that of course, is the potential for the superficial layer. We rub millions of these cells off every day. We end up with a new epidermis every 35 to 45 days. In healthy skin, new cells produced equal cells lost at the surface. And of course, friction areas have a higher amount of mitosis because obviously friction is rubbing off the superficial layers much quicker, more aggressively. And this cellular division is partially controlled by something called epidermal growth factor. Melanocytes are specialized cell which produces the pigment melanin. They're found at the deepest layer of the epidermis. They're not up near the top. They're actually quite deep. They are spider-shaped. In other words, they have lots of branches, and they make contact with all the keratinocytes at the basal level. Therefore, they make this granular color, and they're always injecting these most basal layers with the color that we have. And in some cases, as we know, under UV stimulation, more gets produced in protection, which gives us what we know as of a tan. And then based upon our ethnic background, we have various levels of color in our skin, all again produced by these cells. Melanocytes, the pigments, is then moved to the ends of the processes and sloughed off. The keratinocytes ingest it. The melanin accumulates on the sunny side of the nucleus of the keratinocyte to shield against UV rays. All humans have relatively the same amount of melanocytes. It is likely the production of melanin that determines the color of skin, which gives us the wide variety of skin color that we do find in the world. Langerhans cells arise from bone marrow. They're macrophages, and they form a continuous network among the keratinocytes. And the Merkel cells are at the dermal-epidermal junction. They're actually sometimes called a Merkel disc, and they are associated with a disc-like nerve cell called the Merkel disc, which is all about pressure. Okay? There are all these layers to the epidermal layer. We have from the bottom to the top, the deepest is the stratum basale, then the stratum spinosum, stratum granulosum, stratum lucidum, and the stratum corneum. And in thin skin, the lucidum is absent. And in thicker skin, like at our heels, the bottom of our feet, we do have a stratum lucidum, which thickens the skin as a reaction to more pressure and friction and so forth. You remember all this stuff now? Kind of, sort of? No? Don't remember any of it? The dermis is a very strong but flexible connective tissue layer. We find typical cells that we find in most connective tissues. We have fibroblasts, which are responsible for making fibers, color, right? Okay. Macrophages, which eat. Mast cells, which are part of the immune response. White blood cells, which are basically macrophages, right? The dermis is a semi-fluid matrix that is embedded with collagen, elastin, and reticular fibers. And if you remember when we talked about this in the first semester, now each of these sort of help provide a certain amount of strength in their own particular way. So obviously this is what allows our skin to be able to take a lot of stress and friction and abuse and not fall apart on us. Yeah, the dermis binds the entire body like a stocking, and this is your hide. This is what we would make leather out of in an animal if we were to make leather products. It's richly supplied with nerve fibers, blood vessels, and lymphatics. We also do find the hair follicle, oil, and sweat glands within the dermis as well. We sort of see here. The dermis has two major layers. It has a papillary layer and a reticular layer. So we can see this papillary, so it has this pimple-like or nipple-like structures, and that's sort of why we call the papillary what we do. And then the reticular layer lies deep to that, where we find the considerable amount of fibers that help give strength to the dermal level. So the papillary layer is it is a connective tissue in which the fibers form a woven mat. Lots of blood vessels here. The superior surface, though, is thrown into this nipple-like configuration, these high extensions, if you wish to call, known as the dermal papillae, hence the reason for the name of this layer. This indents into the overlying epidermis, and within these papillae, we find these capillary loops, and in some cases, we find what are called free nerve endings, which, of course, gives us the ability to feel pain, heat, cold, pressure, tickle, and so forth. On the palms and soles of the feet, the papillae lie on top, larger mounds called dermal ridges, which produce these looped and whorled ridges, which we know as fingerprints. And yes, we have toe prints too. The ridges increase gripping ability and therefore increase friction. The patterns are genetically predetermined, and no two people have the same. Due to the sweat pores that open along the ridges, of course, this is why we leave fingerprints. And as we all know now with cell phones and all the swiping and everything else, we have to clean our front of our glass of our phone probably how often? So we can see here the epidermal ridges and these papillae. We can see sort of the configuration here, increases surface area, allows a great attachment between the two, between the epidermal and the dermal layer, increases the surface area, also allows these nerve endings and blood vessels to get higher up into serving their roles, whether it's sensory information or whether it's delivering blood to the epidermal surface. The reticular layer is the deeper layer, so that it accounts for a greater percentage of the dermal layer. It's typically dense, irregular connective tissue. Why? Why? What do we find irregular connective tissue here? What is irregular connective tissue? What's the difference? So we have two types of connective tissue. We have dense regular connective tissue, and we have dense irregular connective tissue. What does dense regular connective tissue usually make up anatomically? Where do we find dense regular connective tissue? I'm so disappointed I tell you all this stuff. Tendons. Tendons. That's regular, meaning that the fibers run parallel to each other along the longitudinal axis of the tendon. So why do we have dense, irregular connective tissue under the skin? You remember my famous saying that I drilled into your head? I thought I did, and said it over and over and over and over again in class. Structure governs function. So why do we have dense, irregular connective tissue here? Because the fibers provide what? Structure and another word with S. Yeah, I could support or another word with S. Strength. So when we have irregular fibers, it means that the skin can be pulled in any direction and has strength. Remember I talked about with regular connective tissue in a tendon, right? There is a direction of force the tendon is extremely powerful in. And that would be, in the case of functioning muscles, the tension that was created when the muscle contracted. And we could pull along that line and not do much damage to the tendon. If I apply a significant force perpendicular to the parallel fibers, then the tendon is weaker and you have a greater potential for damage and so forth, right? So when we look at dense regular connective tissue as a tendon, its purpose is to efficiently take the tension that was created by the shortening muscle and apply it along the line to affect the bone that it, of the joint that it crosses to have the movement. Dense irregular connective tissue is so that the skin can be pulled in a myriad of directions and be strong and well supported. It's not going to tear. The which? No, I wouldn't think so. I guess you could say that the pericardium would be irregular. Yes, not the heart itself, because it's muscle, right? So the matrix contains thick bundles of collagen fibers that run in various planes. The majority run parallel to the surface. Less dense regions between these bundles form lines of cleavage or tendon lines, and they run longitudinal in the skin of the heads and limbs in a circular pattern around the neck and trunk. So when we look at these cleavage lines, they tend to run this way in the extremities, and they tend to run this way in the core. The collagen gives strength and resiliency. Of course, as we know, collagen binds with water, which helps give it the ability to slip and slide and have the range that it affords the tissue. Extreme stretching can tear the dermis, which results in what we call striae or stretch marks. And of course, a blister, if you remember the famous picture I've got with the individuals with half the skin of their heel gone, right, peeled back. That's what a blister is, a collection of fluid between the dermis and the epidermis. And what you're seeing is the epidermis pulling away from the underlying dermis. Flexure lines reflect dermal modification. So that's the lines that we see in terms of the palms of our hands and the creases we see on our wrist and so forth. They occur at or near joints where the dermis is tightly secured. Because that's the other thing that we have to remember is that, you know, certain parts of skin is attached, because if it wasn't, it would all kind of sag down and end at our ankles at some point. So at the sacrum, the olecranon area and so forth, we have areas where the dermis is much tighter to the body and helps maintain it where it's supposed to be. So there's your striae there. We have a significant one on the left and possibly a post-maternity type of stretch mark that we'd find on the right. That is the famous heel. So what you're seeing curled up there is the epidermis. And what you guys think that's a bad picture? You wait till you see the pictures I have for pathology. Oh, the greatest thing in the world is, what did you say? When I actually get into the pathology themselves, whenever you look at pictures that represent a disease state, of course, they pick the worst possible presentation of the disease state, right? So the white part is the epidermis and the pink underneath is the dermal layer. Sorry? Where? There's no hair there. Oh, right there. I think that's on the screen. Of course, we know that skin tells us a lot from a pathological sense, right? We can look at the skin and based upon its color, it can tell us a lot when we're doing the observation part of our assessment. The lady on the left there, that's actually called contact dermatitis, which we'll be talking about today. And that, if you think about it, that's kind of an area where you might put a moisturizer on yourself before you go to bed at night, right? What's that? Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, you put a lotion on your neck. Yeah, that's from a lotion that she's taken an allergic reaction to. The lady on the right there, she's got a condition called rosacea. This is a before and after pic because rosacea is a fairly common condition. And through laser therapy, there are places now that are able to help people with rosacea if they happen to have it significant enough. Blanched skin, of course, is important for looking at possible certain anemias. So you can see in the gentleman on the right, that tissue around the eye should be nice and red and pink, and it is not, it's very white. So So that could give us an indication that there's some kind of anemia or something like that going on. That is not a reproduced picture that's been colorized. That is an individual who's in end stage, probably cirrhosis of the liver, and that is the collection of bilirubin because the liver is failing, and that's what color you get. It's just not mature enough. So what they do is they put you in UV lights in your incubator. Incubator, it's not an incubator, it's a whatever. And it resolves itself as the liver continues to mature and then starts dealing with the bilirubin. They don't get quite this bad. The first time I saw an individual with jaundice was unfortunately a gentleman who was a brother of one of the girls I worked with in the cardiorespiratory department. I didn't know that at the time. And their jaundice was so significant because they were at very end stage cirrhosis. I thought that they were of African-American descent because it had collected that much and their skin had darkened that much with the collection of bilirubin under the skin. Bronzing is this exactly that. You get this bronze color. This is part of a condition called Addison's disease. Bruising, of course, that tells us a lot. Right, the one on the right would represent someone who's on blood thinners, who probably didn't do much damage to themselves at all, but because of blood thinners, the blood just, this ecchymosis, just, the blood just goes into the interstitial spaces. Yeah. Yes, especially in the gums of Addison's disease, yes. Okay, so that's your review. Sounded like you needed it. So, that being said then, we remember, you know, the parts that are skin and the cells and so forth. It gives us a bit of an introduction to some of the pathologies we're going to talk about. And I can tell you guys, not for you to feel sorry for me or anything, there's two sets of slides here. And this second one, Integumentary Pathology Part 2, I just finished about 45 minutes ago to an hour ago. I did. Week 3. So here we go. We're going to have three sets of slides this week. The plan is we're going to talk a little bit with the cellular part here. We're going to look at some pathologies in the second part, and there's a third part, which are neoplasms of the skin, which will likely be next week. So again, like all my slide sets, when I'm introducing something new to you, a new system, I do put in a lot of definitions that sort of pertain to common things that words have come up to sort of express what we see. Skin's a very interesting thing because we are very hardwired to see normal skin, and we are very disturbed when we see bad skin that has got significant problems with it, right? Significant seborrhea or psoriasis or something like that, right? So we kind of struggle a bit with bad skin. But with all the things that can happen to skin, we do have a number of definitions that represent some of the things that can happen to skin when it's dealing with these pathological states. So a macule is a flat, distinct, discolored area of skin. A papule is a small, raised, solid pimple or swelling, often forming or within part of a rash on the skin. It's typically inflamed, so it's red, it's raw looking, but it does not produce pus. So we don't see like a whitehead or anything on it. A wheal. So does anybody know what a wheal is? Yeah, you'll tend to see it. Now, there's an immune response called a wheal. Have you guys done it before where you take and you scratch your skin and you give your skin a good scratch and you see the red kind of come up where the scratch was? You don't break the skin. You're just kind of running it down. You notice you ever tried that, right? That's a wheal. And that's just inflammation that quickly comes to the skin. So it is a red, swollen mark left on flesh by a blow or pressure. A vesicle, on the other hand, is a thin-walled sac filled with fluid, which is usually quite clear, and it tends to be very small, whereas a pustule is a small, inflamed, pus-filled, blister-like sore on the skin surface. Now, do you guys have a little bit of like, witches and Halloween and whatever in your head, you know, with Shakespeare and his witches. Remember the witches? No. Another term that will be new to you is something called excoriation. Now, excoriation is abrading or the wearing off of skin. So sometimes we have a condition where one layer of skin will just start peeling off. Did anybody hear? Who's got children here? Nobody's got children here? Or nephews or whatever? Did they get any of the hand, foot, and mouth? Yeah, and is it peeling off their hands and feet? Yeah, so eventually all that skin will just start peeling off. That is a, no. Yeah, that's called excoriation. So both my grandsons had it. It went through the schools last spring before the end of school like crazy. Kids, all the kids had it. Adults can have it, and they generally don't have a symptomology, but you're the carrier. So go and see kids, and you'll give it to the kids, and then they get the skin changes and whatever. Yeah, it's gone crazy through the schools a few times. So excoriation then is a braiding or wearing off of the skin. A fissure is a split in the skin, usually to the point of bleeding. A nevus is benign, and it is formed by a cluster of melanocytes. So we kind of think of it almost as like a mole. A pruritus is itching. So wherever you see pruritus, you're going to see pruritus a lot in integumentary pathology, because one of the things I can tell you about a lot of things our skin gets, itches. Urticaria are hives. Erythema is superficial reddening of the skin, usually in patches as a result of injury or irritation, causing a dilation of the blood capillaries. Macula I have again. Sorry, I didn't know I had it there twice. So there are some, yes. It's still the same thing. It's still, yeah, it could. So it's still a flat lesion, which is exactly what the top one says. And then you could further define it that they're usually about a centimeter in diameter or so. So when we come across new terms as well, especially ones that seem very odd, I do generally tend to put in brackets what they mean to try to remind us going back to it. So skin lesions. So does anybody have their book with them, please? Page 400, box 10-1. Because I notice nobody ever brings their books here. Why not? Come on. You do arm curls with this thing, right? Guess what they did for us? I'm so excited. For some reason, somebody got really nice and decided to give staff members gym membership for free for a year. Yeah? Here? No. No, no. It used to be that we had a deal with the union. We got half price. I still pay for parking, too. I pay as much for parking as you do. Bus pass? No. Nope. Because you need a one card for that, right? Yeah, I don't have one card. No, they get reduced tuition. Well, I've got the mic on here, but my biggest complaint isn't free parking. I'll pay for parking, but I'm always shocked that there's no staff parking here. So my very first day on the job here, 18 years ago, I had a class, and I came here, and I couldn't find a parking spot. I was 45 minutes late for my first class. Because literally the entire campus, there wasn't a parking spot anywhere. It's ridiculous. What did I say? What's the box? No. Oh, they know. They know there's not enough parking. They know that. Have you ever noticed how they're the smallest parking spots you've ever seen in your life? Because they went to the most minimum size to get the most. But the nice thing is though, with a lot of the remote learning now, I don't have a problem finding a park. You guys find, you never have a problem finding a park spot anymore. What's that? Yeah. So when we think of causes skin lesions, just to go through quickly. So we have hereditary factors, we have physical trauma, we have systemic origins, so diseases with that expressed through the cutaneous layer. We have burns, dehiscad surgical wounds, neoplasms, reaction to radiotherapy, contact with infective organisms, reaction to medication, contact with injurious agents like chemical toxins, and reactions to allergens. A whole bunch of stuff can get expressed through damage to the skin or through the skin's reaction to something else, right? Even medications, right? You can get hives or all sorts of things from medications. So they can be classified as either primary or secondary lesions. Primary lesions are the first lesion to appear on the skin and has a recognizable structure. So it's been looked at. Maybe it produces either a macule or a papule. Maybe it produces what's called a plaque. So think of a plaque as just a hard kind of crusty. I don't know if you know anybody who's got back eczema, but you know, you get those, that crust on top, like the plaque that they just can kind of peel off. Yeah, real bad. Would it? Yeah, and you could just literally peel it off, right? Yes. Right. You do as well? Yeah. Nodules, tumors, wheals, vesicles, and pustules. So anything's possible depending on the pathology from the primary lesion. A secondary lesion are changes that occur in the primary lesion. So maybe initially you get, say, a papule that eventually scales or gets crusty or thickens or the pigmentation changes. You're good. If you've had it that bad for that long, I'm surprised your pigment hasn't changed. Interesting. Yeah, because usually if you have it long-standing, chronic, the pigment of the skin actually changes. A different color, yes? Yeah, exactly. So we look at that. Sometimes you get excoriation, so the skin starts falling off the side, whatever it might be. The changes can occur due to scratching, rubbing, medication, natural progression, or process of healing. So that's the other. You'll learn in some of the pathology. Part of the pathology is you scratch the hell out of yourself, and you break the skin down and get it bleeding or whatever it may be. It's all part of the process of the disease state, right? So primary is the first one. Secondary is something that comes after it. Another type of skin lesion is actually what we call as a birthmark, and they're commonly caused by what is known as a nevus, which is, you know, kind of the mole family, and what they are is, you know, an accumulation of melanin in an area from melanocytes. They can be overgrowth of normal components of skin, so it could be the pigment cells that cause it, a coloration of the skin. It could be an accumulation of blood vessels that under the skin, they give a particular color, and also lymph. So we have pigment types known as cafe au lait spots or Mongolian spots. You've not seen that before? Okay. Vascular types, which are known as either a port wine stain or a strawberry hemangioma. Now, strawberry hemangioma is a much more significant stain than this. It actually is thickened actually because it's an accumulation of blood vessels. And sometimes a hemangioma can actually hang off, and it has to be, and sometimes it can't be removed because vascular-wise, it's involved the tissue so much they can't just go in and snip it off, unfortunately. And you all quite often will hear about, you know, an unfortunate child who gets brought into sick kids because they have a significant hemangioma that's causing blindness or whatever, and they go down for a particular surgery. There are epidermal types of these birthmarks. There's an epidermal nevus, a nevus sebaceous, and then the connective tissue type is something called juvenile elastoma or a collagenoma. So we see here, this is the cafe au lait and a port wine stain. This is the Mongolian spot that we see here. I'm surprised we haven't changed the name of it, to be quite frank. It's kind of surprising to me, but they still call it that. On here, there is a strawberry hemangioma on a four-month-year-old child there on the left. I'm sorry, four-month-year-old. Yeah. The on the right on the top is an epidermal nevus. So this is just an accumulation, again, of melanin into the area that extends off the skin. In the middle, we have something called nevus sebaceous, which is actually growth on the skin there. See how you're all starting to feel a little uncomfortable now because you're seeing skin, because we react. I know. Yes. You know, we have to remember skin is an organ. And like any other organ that gets disease states, the skin can just as much. And but because we see it, because it projects out from us, you know, it's a little more uncomfortable sometimes for us to. Can you imagine being a dermatologist, right? And some of the things that you might see in a practice, it would be quite amazing, right? Oh, I had terrible adolescent acne, like the whole face, you know, the whole T thing and big deep blind pimples and all that kind of stuff. And I went to a dermatologist every couple of weeks. And if I had a blind pimple, everybody knows what a blind pimple is, right? So the pore is blocked, but instead of kind of sticking out the hole, you get this big, thick whatever. So she'd put me on a table under a huge magnifying glass and take the needle part of a needle, and then she'd find the pore and she'd shove it right in. And she called it her torture table, and that was her treatments. And then she had a special device, because you don't squeeze a pimple, because if you do, connective tissue on either side of perpendicular to the squeeze will break down. That's when you get the scarring and the pop marks. So she had this little round device with a hole in the middle, and she'd push down on top of the on top of what she did to get the pus and that out of it. Yeah, the girls don't understand that. Did you have adolescent acne much? I'm on your back. Yeah, I had a buddy who had a terrible back. Bill had a terrible back growing up. The girls don't normally get that. Some girls get it, but yeah. It's hormones. It's just in terms of the changes in hormones during adolescence, it promotes oil growth. Like, I don't know what your back was like, but my face, like, I can almost drip oil off my forehead. I produced so much oil as an adolescent. No, that was just adolescence. No. Oh, it's not that. It's not that we don't all get acne. Of course, I get acne every now and then. But that whole T zone, sort of adolescent thing, yeah. Yeah. You know what's interesting though? I had an experience after I left high school, and I was working in Toronto. I ended up living in a rooming house in High Park. I don't know if anybody here is from Toronto. The reason I'm bringing this up is because a guy who lived in the house with me, he was from Hong Kong. And we would end up eating dinner together, and that was sort of my first introduction to real Chinese food, to be honest. But he couldn't get over, he said, acne in Chinese culture is very accepted. Nobody has a hard time with it. And he said, you know, he came to Canada, and he can't believe everybody's on our creams and lotions and makeup and everything else, right? And he's like, I go home, everybody's got it. Nobody says anything. We all know it's just part of, you know, growing up or whatever, and they don't have an issue with it. It's quite interesting. So when we think about dermatologic diseases, the most common manifestation, as I said, is pruritus, is itching, right? So we have a lot of nerve endings in our skin. So when the skin gets irritated in a pathological state, the most major problem we have is we want to scratch it. The thing is, when we have these diseases, also they can be a symptom of underlying systemic disease. So that's why they always have to be checked. Because we might think it's just simply a skin disease, but it could be representing something far more serious that's deeper into the physiology of the body. Xerosis, or just dry, rough skin, is the most common cause of pruritus. So we get dry, rough skin, it gets itchy, and we scratch it. Now everybody's scratching now, right? Just because we're talking about it, right? Scratching can result in damage to the skin, which can lead to increased inflammation, infection, and scarring. And that's the secondary problem with scratching, right? How many people here have scratched yourself? Do you bleed sometime? How many people here have had, for heaven's sakes. No, three-leaf plant. Poison ivy. How hard is it not to scratch? It is the hardest thing you will ever do, not to scratch poison ivy. They seem to be, yes. I've had it a whole bunch of times in my life. As a child, I got it terribly. And I think that's what set me up. I was probably like 8 or 9, and I got it literally everywhere. Yeah. I did have it, like, my mom took me to the hospital because I did have it on my genitalia, all around my anus, my glutes, everything. And the only question the doctor asked me, I'll never forget it because I was 8 years old and expecting a professional, and he looks at me and goes, "Does it hurt when you piss?" And I went, "Did you just say that to me?" Right? Do doctors talk like that? And that was the only thing he was concerned with. Other than that, it was just like literally putting calamine on. And I seem to be more susceptible. Now, what's very odd is I got it at golf this year. I went in to look for my brother's ball, and I only got a couple little tiny spots, because usually what happens is little tiny spots just start to go crazy. And it's not that the lesions are infectious. It's whether or not you have the poison ivy oil on your skin that you need to get rid of. So the worst time is, and it happened a couple times this summer, after rain and you're walking through the bush, is really bad for poison ivy because it's wet and the oil comes off, and that oil gets on the skin. It irritates the skin and causes a significant inflammatory reaction, and that's where the itch and burn comes from. It's interesting. I one time, it was a bit of an inside track I had, I got it bad in my arms. And I went into the emerge, and there was a physician there, and I said, "Sai, like, I can't have poison ivy. I'm doing massage. Like, I got to work. What do I do?" He said, "No problem." So he gave me prednisone. And it worked like a charm. It really did. Just a few days' worth. It wasn't anything crazy. But, oh, has anybody here ever done prednisone? I was like, psh, 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 psh. Like 4 hours a night, and that's all I needed to sleep, and I was just raring to go. It was like drinking like 100 coffees. Yeah. My mom's on her. You know, you talk about skin. Well, actually, it makes your face round, makes your thorax round, destroys your skin. It's all long. So my mom right now is in that boat. She's been on prednisone for quite some time with her skin, and she was sitting in a chair back in the summer, and somebody brought their dog in who jumped on my mom's leg and tore about a 4-inch part of her leg, and this is 6 weeks later and it's still not healed because her skin's too thin, and that's all because of prednisone. I think I told you guys the story that one time I was in the hospital and I had to take some blood from a lady, and I thought she was sweating, and she wasn't. It was actually interstitial fluid was purling up through the skin because it was so thin it had no integrity to hold the internal fluids anymore. Another thing, so scratching can result, as we said, as cirrhosis from the dry skin. Remember, itching is pruritus. Cirrhosis is dry, rough skin. Urticaria is a vascular skin reaction, and you end up with smooth, slightly elevated patches that we know as wheals that can be redder or paler than the surrounding skin. And again, urticaria can also be itchy. These are usually an allergic reaction from either drugs, and they only last for a couple of days. They're not too bad. But urticaria can have a chronic presentation that lasts for longer than 6 weeks to many years, depending on the reason why. Yeah. Well, if I slapped you, what do you see? Where and what pattern? Exactly, because it wheeled up, because the skin is wheeling up at that point of impact. No, it can be we used to use it for inflammation. Just, you know, just take your nail, scratch fairly well down your skin, and that line, the nail went down, you'll see this red sort of raised wheel will come up where you scratched. No, that's erythema underneath. So that's from vasodilation underneath the friction. This is something that if it, like literally, if I slapped you hard enough, and we got really close to the skin, you'd actually see it's raised a little bit. There's actually a little bit of edema, and with the redness, that the skin raises just a little tiny bit. Rash, of course, is a generalized term for an eruption on the skin. Most often we see rashes in the face, trunk, axilla, and groin. And again, itching is usually the chief complaint. It can present as a continuum from erythema to macular lesions to a raised papular appearance. So when we talk about rashes, it can be quite seriously just reddening of the skin. It can be these flat macular lesions that we see on the skin, Or it could be this papular appearance, which again are almost like tiny little pimples but aren't pussy. It really depends on what's causing the rash. They typically occur as a secondary response to a primary agent. So maybe sun exposure results in a rash, allergen to something, an irritant, so something in the air or you're using, medications or systemic diseases. A common cause is prolonged exposure to urine or feces, which we see in the long-term care environment. So sometimes, unfortunately, individuals end up spending extended amounts of time in a diaper with that area exposed to feces and or urine, which irritates the skin and causes a rash. And believe it or not, it is no different than the rash that we see in a newborn, who again is experience long exposure to the same contents on their bottom. We also can have a drug rash, a heat rash, and also what's called a butterfly rash, which is associated with lupus. So anybody know what this rash is? Lyme disease, right? And that's erythema. You can see it's just red. Here we've got papules. You see the raised tips on them? This is, what do I guess? You already said it. Chickenpox, right? And this is the butterfly rash that comes with a condition called lupus erythematosus. And it's a connective tissue disorder, an autoimmune disorder, and it causes that particular pattern of rash. Blisters are another thing that we can see as a result of conditions. So these are also known as vesicles or bulla. They are fluid-containing elevated skin lesions with serous or bloody content. So it could be the leaking serous fluid underneath or blood. They are primarily associated with genetic or autoimmune diseases. They may be secondary to viral or bacterial skin infections as well, or from direct skin injury, of course, or drug reactions. They can be related to cancer with a condition called paraneoplastic pemphigus. So we have subepithelial autoimmune blistering dermatosis here. We can see the fluid is collected here under the skin. And then we have the paraneoplastic pemphigus, which is a type of cancer that we see here. Yes. That's a type of cancer. Told you I had lots of good pictures. That's impetigo on the left, and then virus-related blisters there on the right. And they're just raised. Again, they're just separations between the epidermis and the dermis. There's something called xeroderma, which is a mild form of ichthyosis, which is excessive dryness. See all the terminology? It's a bit different, eh? So mild form of ichthyosis, which is excessive dryness. We get dry, rough, discolored skin with scaly desquamation. So breaking down of the skin itself. This is a condition that can be the result of, you know, just irritated skin. And then we go and exacerbate it with something, a chemical form like a skin cleanser or a soap, or contact with disinfectants or solvents. So we can see it here. Exoderma there on the right. Can you see a bit of the dryness there in the skin? But this is the squamation. So we're actually losing a layer of skin as a reaction to something that they've been using. And it just literally starts peeling off. As a therapist who observes their patient in various states of undress, you will come across spots, rashes, molds, cysts, fibromas, nodules, edema, and or changes in nail beds. The thing you need to remember that's really important is, I'll ask all you guys right here, when is the last time you took a good look at your back? If ever, right? What do we see all the time? Your backs. So it's kind of important for us to understand changes that can occur in skin. So because we are maybe the only one who's sort of taking the time to look at someone's skin, actual skin, and kind of, you know, I don't know, many occasions I've asked patients, you know, I noticed you have a mole around your scapula. Did you always have that? Oh, yes. Yeah. It's quite large. Has it always been large? No. Well, it's quite large now. You know, it might be a good idea to go and speak. speak to a physician about it and make sure that it's okay, right? Again, it's not our role to diagnose by any means, but we should recognize that, you know, the responsibility and recognition observing wise, whether something is appropriate or not on the skin when we're looking at it. Anything that is appeared recently or changed since the initial appearance should be examined by a qualified practitioner. So anything, you know, if you're seeing a patient regularly and they come in one day and they have some kind of lesion on the skin, that definitely warrants a conversation and possibly a look at by a practitioner. Varicosities and or signs of poor venous return can be indicated by changes in skin pigmentation, turgor, and texture. What's turgor? What's turgor? Then tension? Well, that's showing the turgor of the skin. So it's that ability of, you know, is the skin reacting well to putting a line of pressure on it, right? Is it tough? Yeah. What'd you say? What's it say?
I said pressure.
Yeah.
But that's my
rigidity of cells and tissues. Yeah. So when you push on it, is it kind of falling apart on you, like my mom with her thin skin with prednisone, or is it extra tight or whatever it might be? Lower extremity edema, which you might be observing, can be associated with multiple systemic conditions such as heart disease, kidney disease, or liver disease. So again, we're kind of paying attention to what's happening. Okay. We need a pee break. Let's take a quick pee break, say for 10. No more. Oh, we did this one, didn't we? Yeah, sorry, wrong one. I don't understand hairless cats. No, that's human being weird. No cat would evolutionarily create no hair. Okay, part two. Common skin disorders. The biggest one is something called atopic dermatitis. This is a chronic or relapsing inflammatory skin disease that is characterized by pruritus, right? Itchy skin, which includes dried skin, skin disease, allergies, and diabetes. It's one of the most common forms of eczema. Can be present during the first year of life. 30% of children get atopic dermatitis. Crazy, eh? 30%. That 30% quite often, this condition persists into adulthood. This AD is one manifestation of something called atopy, which is a group of three associated allergic disorders. Asthma, allergic rhinitis, which we know is a fever, and atopic dermatitis. So they tend to be a reactive condition to allergies. Patients with AD often have a personal or family history of allergic disorders. The etiological and risk factors, the causes are multifaceted. There are genetic reasons, there are immunologic reasons, and there are environmental factors, which makes sense, right, if it's an allergic sort of thing. Two risk factors have been linked, family history and aberrant skin barrier gene coding. So seems that allergies tend to be a little bit genetic, and then in some cases, unfortunately, the genetics of the cells in the skin, something's wrong with the genetic code, and they can't keep a good sort of strong, healthy skin, and therefore the risk is higher. Unclear if inflammation exacerbates dysfunction or if a problem with the skin barrier causes immune dysregulation. They're not sure. Stress and emotional problems can worsen if you have it, but it doesn't cause it. Associated with sensitization to food allergens, which seems to be all over the place now. Everybody seems to have quite a number of them. We tend to come across them. Avoidance diet is recommended solely by allergy testing. And this is where, and some of you are going to argue with me, when you say I don't eat gluten, right? Because I'm gluten sensitive. Have you been tested? No, I have not. Then you don't know if you're gluten sensitive or not. Well, when I don't eat gluten, my headaches go away, or I'm not as flatulent. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're gluten intolerant. Right? So the idea that the book talks about quite a bit is that these food sensitivities we have, you've got to have allergy testing to know whether or not they are a sensitivity, not just, you know, the anecdotal conversations people have. Right? Who is truly gluten intolerant? As tested? What individuals are gluten intolerant? Celiac, right. But you have to be tested for it, correct? And then you know. Xerosis is usually worse during periods of low humidity. So you were saying in the wintertime, that's when you're just like, yeah, dried out, goes crazy. Yes. My ex, her knees will get bad in the wintertime. They're just bad. The skin has a reduced water-binding capacity. It has a higher trans-epidermal water loss and a decreased water content. So it's interesting. It doesn't bind water well. It has a lot more water loss as compared to other skin and therefore has a decreased water content in it. It's dry, it's flaky, and it's not moist. Commonly, AD begins during infancy in the form of a red, oozing, crusting rash that typically appears as a diaper rash, which we see here on this young individual on the top left. You can see the crusting there, right? See a little bit of the crusting? As the child grows, the chronic form results in skin that is dry, thickened, and brownish gray in color. As the individual becomes older, this rash becomes localized more in the large folds of the extremities. So usually on the flexor surfaces, anterior neck, which was your case, sides of the face, eyelids, and dorsal surfaces of the hands and feet. My partner right now, hers are her eyelids. And I haven't really come across it that bad with eyelids, but her eyelids are significant. And hers is in the wintertime as well, when they start getting really bad. Xerosis and Pruritus are the major symptoms that can cause severely excoriated lesions, infection, and scarring. So did you scratch a lot when it was bad? Yeah, which still leads to the greater potential of secondary infection because you're breaking the skin down and so forth, right? Viral bacterial. Now, everybody has heard of Staphylococcus aureus, right? And fungal infection secondary may cause further skin changes. Staph aureus lives on our skin. It's there all the time. It's one of those symbiotic bacteria that we have, which is totally fine until we break the skin. And then it can cause a significant infection. It also is one of the causes for necrotizing fasciitis, right, is the bacteria that lives on our skin. But if you're scratching the skin, therefore the skin breaks down and it's open and it's not protecting, then the potential for a secondary infection is quite high. A Staph aureus infection can result in extensive crusting, serous weeping, folliculitis, which is inflammation of the hair follicles, pyoderma, which is pus formation, and furunculosis, which are boils. How do we manage it? The first is to break the inflammatory cycle. So you've got to somehow get this inflammation under control in order to help it. We can do this through topicals and systemic medications such as antibiotics, antihistamines, antimicrobials, corticosteroids, immunosuppressants, and nonsteroidals. Were you on anything? Because it hurt?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I would imagine it would be a corticosteroid, I would think. Oh, interesting. Did it dry it up worse? Yeah. Interesting. UV radiation is sometimes used, so going into like tanning beds. Yeah, yes. And that's why, I know with my partner as well, when the summertime comes and she's outside all the time, everything just calms right down. Controlling or minimizing triggers and skin care is the focus. So making sure the skin is clean, daily moisturizing with appropriate moisturizers, not just anything over the counter. I'm sure you use moisturizers. Yeah, on top, yeah. And avoidance of irritants, anything that irritates it, right? Like the cream. Dietary recommendations based on appropriate testing should be specific. So if there is a determination of a pre-existing food sensitivity through testing, then of course the first thing they'll do is say don't eat that because it could cause this to be worse. So we see it in the child here initially. These are kind of the common looks that we see. I'm sure we've all got friends who unfortunately suffer terribly with some forms of this. We tend to see this is what we're seeing in the anterior neck, and then of course this large crusty scaling that we see in the ankles and in the elbow and arm area. The next one is called contact dermatitis. I sort of alluded to that one. We saw the picture of the woman who I guess had put some moisturizing cream or something on. It can be acute or chronic skin inflammation caused by exposure to an external agent that may act as an allergen or irritant. Now, it could be chemical, mechanical, physical, or biologic agent like a topical medication. It could be fragrance or common items like a silicone cell phone cover. If it is acutely inflamed, then it is a local contraindication, like any other acute inflammation. We wouldn't go there. Yeah, we wouldn't go there. No. Because you've got broken down skin there and the possibility of introducing infection to it. You've got inflammation there, which, of course, is a contraindication at any time, no matter where it is. So we would leave it alone. So this, when I go through these sort of causes, then, I've had patients who've come, like one of the worst culprits for contact dermatitis is Tide. Yeah. Tide's one of the worst. It's one of the first things I would recommend to people if I see it. Like, and it tends to be more global, right? So it's wherever your clothes are, and if you're using a cream, moisturizing cream, it's much more specific. But Tide is notorious for causing contact dermatitis. Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, I know what you mean. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, okay. Yep. Right? I had a friend in school. He liked wearing rings, and he could always tell it was a lousy ring because it would just flare right up right underneath the ring. If it was good gold, no problem. Everything's fine. Yeah. So, when someone comes and even insulin pumps, I thought it was kind of interesting, and I don't know if anybody here has it or is willing to disclose it, but, you see them out more and more where, they've got the things on their arm and so forth. Those things can cause a kind of contact dermatitis. But for me, I know in the hospital setting, everything was like, no silicone. Like, you really had to ask the question, gloves, IV tubes, or silicone, both. You could have either or, right? So we were always asking. But in the book, it talks about how a culprit is a silicone cell phone cover. Who knew? This is one of the most common environmental skin diseases and can occur at any age. So common allergies, nickel, wool fats, so lanolin, which is quite often found in moisturizers, right? Common moisturizers for skin moisturizers, rubber additives, topical antibiotics such as neomycin or bacitracin. I always say that one wrong. Topical anesthetics like benzocaine or lidocaine. Now, we don't see those here. So the textbook is American. So I don't know if you guys know, but you can actually buy lidocaine over the counter in a drugstore in the U.S. Can you? Same as corticosteroids. Like here, over the counter, I think is 0.1%, right? I think it's 0.1%. You can get 5% over the counter in Ireland as well. Yeah, you can get 5% in the U.S. Corticosteroids, which are normally used to treat the condition, can cause it, right? So it could be that you had actually an allergic reaction to something that for everyone else worked really well for them, but for you it didn't, right? And silicone sensitivity. It's manifestations, you get intense pruritus, which is itching, erythema, and edema of the skin can occur 1 to 2 days post-exposure in previously sensitized persons. Now, these can begin at the site where the contact was made, but they can move other places as well, now, depending on if there's scratching occurring and so forth. The condition can progress to fasciculation, oozing, crusting, and scaling. So it can get pretty significant. If symptoms persist, of course, the skin becomes thickened with prominent markings and pigmentation changes. So medical management is, we have to realize that even in contact dermatitis, because it somewhat comes and goes, we then want to just, you know, recognize it's going to resolve itself in most cases in somewhere around a couple of weeks to 3 or 4 weeks. Chronic lesions persist until the causative agent is removed. So if, you know, it continues to hang around, there's obviously something in your life, food, soap, whatever it may be, that you need to start taking a deeper dive on to stop using. Primary treatment is removal of the causative agent, and treatment of the skin is secondary. If we do require treatments, it would be very similar to atopic dermatitis. So all we can see here is the ring. What's that look like, ladies? Could be eye cream, could be makeup, right? You can see it's very specific to where you might be applying something. This is a bit of a wheel. Can you see how it's raised, right? And then this, of course, could be hand cream, could be you had your hands, you were washing something in the sink, right, you were allergic to. Could be that you work in an area. Like, this is, you know, I always come back to this. This is why we created Wimif, so people were very aware of what they might be working with that could be really detrimental to them, like solvents or those sorts of things, right, to be aware of, you know, because this could be someone who's working in a setting where they were working with a solvent and they weren't wearing protection on the skin.
That's like when I graduated from Laurier.
A polar bear keeper?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
They have polar. And it was funny, like, my hands in the winter, like, every other part of my body would get dry, and I'll get a dry skin, but never been a polar bear. My hands, I don't wear gloves, anything like that. And all of a sudden, my hands started to get, like, really scaly and weird, and we were all off, and we were like, is it starting to do, like, bears or something like that? And then we, like, realized that I was doing all the dishes.
It fantastically took the skin off your hand.
Yeah,
we used to get dermatitis in the grocery store. So my dad, I think it's because my dad had a grocery store butcher shop, and the cardboard. So if you're bringing boxes all the time because it dries, it soaks up all the moisture, and you'd get this kind of dermatitis on your hand just from working in the. They're no good. Best, but the softest my hands ever were is during hunt season when we work on bears. Bears are very fat in the fall, preparing for the winter, and they have the highest lanolin of most animals. So literally your skin on your hands would just be as soft could be. Out of bear meat? Out of bear fat? Oh, maybe. Because lamb is the one that normally gets used. A lot of lanolin comes from wool, so they take lamb and... what's old lambs called? Mutton. Take the old lambs, because the lamb we eat are little babies, right? Did you not know that? I just ruined it for you, didn't I?
Do you know they cry when they kill
them? Oh, is she? Oh. I remember the first time I had to do that, I was like, oh my God, they cry.
I don't know. That makes a good point. How are we even like
It got to the point. Honestly, it would get to the point. I would be wearing rubber boots in blood, eating my lunch, because it's what you get used to, right? All right, eczema and dermatitis. Their terms are exchangeable. They describe a group of disorders with a characteristic appearance. This is a superficial, itchy inflammation of the skin caused by an irritant exposure, could be called irritant dermatitis, allergic sensitization, or delayed hypersensitivity. So again, an allergic or atopic dermatitis, or it could be a genetic determined idiopathic factor. It tends to have forms of it. So some of us know the term seborrhea, which represents dandruff, which we know as dandruff, nummular, which is a discoid form, and stasis dermatitis, which is a venous eczema. And we can see here, you know, sort of it looks here, this is your kind of your normal type. This is nummular, which is discoid, so you sort of get these roundish parts. We get the seborrhea, and that's, again, we always think of seborrhea as being head because of hair, but it also can be facial. When I was looking for a picture online, there was lots of pictures of gentlemen who really suffer badly with, you know, this new desire to have these big, huge beards and stuff like that, and they will get the forms there. And this is what happens with when you start getting venous insufficiency and you start getting the changes that are occurring in the skin there. 40% of people with eczema have other atopic conditions such as food hypersensitivities, allergic rhinitis, and asthma. So very similar to atopic dermatitis, right? So there seems to be an associated sort of allergic sensitivity when it comes to these conditions. There are three primary stages, acute, subacute, and chronic. They can manifest separately or they can all be going on at the same time. So the acute, you end up with extensive erosions with serous exudate. What does that mean? Anybody know? It's a pus. Exudate, serous exudate is just literally the fluid that's under your skin. So it's the broken down and they're just weeping. So there's no pus in it yet. Yeah, you get that wet kind of serous fluid that's coming out, right? So that's what we mean by exudate. And then you've got, and you could have intensely pruritic erythematomas, papules and vesicles. So you can have these bumps, these lumps, itching like crazy. You can have erosions in the skin that are weeping and wet. The subacute form is characterized by erythematous, God, I have trouble with that word, excoriated skin, so that's been scratched or abraded, scaling papules or plaques, that group or scatter over that red skin. So they're kind of lying over top. These scaling papules can be so tiny that on view, the skin looks shiny silver. And then we can get into the chronic form, which is a thickened skin with increased skin marking called lichenification. So you know what lichen is, right? Everybody knows what lichen is? It kind of looks like lichen. And secondary to rubbing and scratching, excoriated papules, fibrotic papules and nodules, prurigo nodularis, and post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation and hypopigmentation. So you start to see this is hyperpigmentation we see here on the stasis dermatitis, right? So we can get, in terms of this status form, we can get to where we start actually having ulceration of the skin where it starts breaking down. So incidence and etiological factors, so we tend to see either of these, you know, again, they're used conversely both ways. Children or older adults may be caused by hypoproteinemia, venous insufficiency, allergens, irritants, or underlying malignancies such as leukemias or lymphoma can result in eczema types of skin as well. Older adults can be taking multiple medications, which can result in dermatitis from drug interaction. So that can be a result. I think I told you guys, right, my record of number of drugs they saw in the hospital. One lady who came in, she was on 32 different medications. So you can imagine the drug interactions that she had. And then aging skin, of course, can result in flattened epidermal dermal junctions, therefore getting a thinning of the dermis, which results in fragile skin. And of course, then you get skin care tears there, and then you up the ante of the possibility of dermatitis. Status dermatitis is a development of these erythematous itchy plaques that may open to form shallow ulcers in the lower legs. This is a result of a venous hypertension. So, yes. Status. Sorry. So what happens is you get a blockage in venous return. Therefore, you get buildup of venous blood, which increases venous pressure. So you get venous hypertension because blood is not moving through. Therefore, this all leads to what's called venous insufficiency. So you're not clearing blood out of the extremity at all. It's kind of hanging around. This increased pressure occurs when there's venous obstruction or damage to the valves, and they permit what is called retrograde venous flow. Retrograde means what? Wrong way or backwards, right? The pressure pushes, this pressure actually pushes red blood cells, proteins, and other cells out through the vessels into the interstitial tissues or spaces. Now they're out there. Now we get a reactive inflammatory response because these materials or compounds are out into the tissues themselves. We get increased edema because of the inflammation, and we also really impair diffusion rates in the tissues because everything's just backed up and not moving. Therefore, we fail to meet the metabolic requirements of the skin, which, of course, breaks the skin down and lowers its viability. So we start to see these kind of changes and eventually get these shallow ulcerations that we can find just due to the insufficiency. How many people here know somebody who suffers from rosacea? Really common. Really common. It is a common chronic facial disorder of middle-aged and older peoples. Believe it or not, it's a form of acne. We used to call it acne rosacea. Some people will get pustules with the rosacea. It is differentiated by age, the presence of large vascular components, so you actually see vessels under the skin, and usually the absence of comedones, which are small flesh-colored white or dark bumps that give skin a rough texture. So we sort of see it here in the picture of the lady that she's had. You can see the vascularity underneath that's accumulated in terms of causing the redness. There's no known cause or factor. It's currently considered a condition with vascular and inflammatory components in the presence of an altered innate immune response. Yeah. We used to think that. Do you remember W.C. Fields? No, you guys don't remember W.C. Fields. He was a famous comedian, and he was known for his big bulbous nose, right? So we used to say, yes, this guy's an alcoholic. We now know there's nothing to do with alcoholism. Yeah. Now, alcohol can exacerbate rosacea. So I had a girlfriend many years ago who was diagnosed with it, and they told her not to drink red wine. She could never drink red wine. She was Italian. Darn near killed her. But the red wine seemed to aggravate. How many people here are friends who get all flushy when they drink wine? All right? So that she was told at the time that can be a pretense to rosacea. Clinically, the cheeks, nose, and chin, sometimes the entire face, may have a persistent rosy appearance marked by reddened skin. With it, you can get pustules, papules. The patient may express burning or stinging skin. Episodic flushing, so that's like the drinking that could be a possible precursor to rosacea, and facial edema. Changes in body or environmental temperatures, UV radiation exposure, and spicy foods can trigger flare-ups. Can worsen over time, resulting in lasting redness, pimples. This word is that. Okay, you start getting that vascularity under the skin that's starting to show through. Keratitis, which is inflammation of the cornea of the our nasal hypertrophy, which is known as rhizophema. So this is rhizophema. And that's a pretty significant expression of it, right? We don't generally tend to see it that large. It tends to be more, those gets kind of bulbous, red, shiny. Rhizophema. Rhinophema. You can have associated ophthalmic disease, so something called blepharitis, which is inflammation of the eyelids, or keratitis, which is inflammation of the cornea of the eye. So it can move into the eye area as well. Management is aimed at the inflammatory papules, pustules, and the surrounding erythema through topicals and or systemic therapies. Some suggest, and I've seen sort of the advertisements online, where they use laser therapies, and it seems to calm down the redness as well. Impetigo. So this is a childhood disease. Kind of makes its ways around. A lot of kids get it. It is highly contagious. It is superficial and normally caused by either staphylococcal or streptococci bacteria. Generally tend to find it in infants and young children somewhere between 2 to 6 years of age and sometimes in adults. Right? Some people look at the pictures and go, I'm never in a kid then. Most often during hot, humid weather. The reason with kids, one of the reasons why it spreads around is because school with close contact and they're touching each other, right? Because kids are always touching each other. They touch themselves first and touch their friends, tends to cause it. Overcrowded living quarters, we'll see it. Poor skin hygiene can result in it. Anemia for whatever reason. Malnutrition and minor skin trauma. It can be spread by direct contact or environmental contamination as well, but the more common one is actually direct skin contact. It occurs in conditions where the skin is broken. So eczema, herpes, zoster, or mosquito bites can make the skin susceptible to this. Generally, you get these macules that rapidly develop into erosive, popular lesions or vesicles, small blisters that become pustular. When the vesicles break, the fluid comes out and you get what's known as the classic honey-colored crust. There. All you do is wipe it off. You just take a wet face cloth and you just kind of wipe it off. All it is that the fluid is coming out and, of course, it's dehydrating and it's crystallizing. So all you do is just wipe it off. That's right. When the vesicles break, I said you get the classic honey-colored crust that develops from the oozing lesions. Itching is common, and scratching can spread the infection. And it's difficult to get kids to stop scratching when they have this. They want to scratch it like mad. These frequently affect the face and extremities, but usually 2 to 3 weeks they close up, they're done. There's no scarring at all. Of course, unless the child scratches the living heck out of themselves and does damage to the skin. Fever, pain, and cellulitis are uncommon in impetigo, and if present, you might be wanting to look for a different diagnosis in impetigo as well. It is self-limiting, and you can use an antibiotic with it. Okay, we'll finish with herpes. So, it arrives from the Greek word for to creep. And this is because the virus has the ability to become chronic, latent, and recurrent. So it hangs around forever, disappears for a while, and it comes back again. The known herpes viruses are divided by genomic and biologic behavior into 8 types. So you might not realize that there are 8 types of herpes out there. We're not going through all 8, but we are going through the common ones that we know or we should know. They are morphologically similar, but their biologic and epidemiological features are different when we compare them. Subclinical primary infections are more common than symptomatic illness, and each type persists in a latent state for the rest of the life of the host. That's really important to understand. You get herpes, you have it for life. It hangs around with you forever until you die. Now, whether or not it stays latent or you have exacerbations can be variable depending on the individuals, but generally we tend to hang on to herpes for the rest of, we hang on to herpes for the rest of our lives. And so when we see these primary infections, these subclinical ones are more common, the breakouts we don't see quite as often. Herpes simplex and varicella zoster remain latent in sensory ganglia. Do you guys remember where the sensory ganglia are from your neuroanatomy class? Yeah? Yeah, you remember seeing them in the pictures, right? With little bulbs, right? So that's where it goes and hangs out. So they hang out there, and then when activated, they travel along the axon of the sensory nerve, and then they break out into the skin along the dermatome of that level. If the host is immunocompromised, of course, this can become much more specific. You could find herpes in more lesions in the central nervous system and in the organs themselves. So on the left is herpes type 1, the traditional cold sore. The herpes on the right is your traditional genital herpes. Type 2. The one on the right is type 2, which is your normal. Where'd that arrow come from? Is it always there? Oh, I thought I put it there. Okay. Sorry. So herpes simplex viruses represent herpes type 1 and herpes type 2. Approximately 70% of Americans older than 14 years have herpes simplex 1 for cold sores. My father used to get them all the time. All the time. I don't know, is anybody here, anybody in the family that gets cold sores quite often? You do, yeah? Yeah. No, well, it'll explain itself here in a second. No. Herpes simplex 2 is one of the most common sexually transmitted diseases in the world, and it's the principal cause of genital ulcers and genital herpes. 2016, 47.8% had type 1 in the U.S., and 12% had type 2. You think of the population? That's a lot. 81% of initial cases go unrecognized because we don't really pay attention to them. They're not that bad. Both can infect any visceral organ, musculocutaneous site, so where we have mucous membranes, and HSV-1 can be transmitted to the genital area during oral sex. So if someone has an active herpes simplex type 1 lesion on their mouth and they have oral sex with their partner, they can transfer that herpes virus into that area. Yes. Well, from a medical perspective, they are slightly different, a bit, which we're going to talk about. We're going to kind of compare the two of them. But this is a fairly new path book, so they still keep type 1, type 2, so I don't know if that's been removed or not. I'm not aware that it's been removed. Intermittent asymptomatic shedding is common and is the typical time of transmission. So you can be shedding the virus and not be sick or be in an act of exacerbation. Okay? So intermittent asymptomatic shedding is common and is the typical time of transmission immediately preceding appearance of sores. So people may engage in sexual practices and not recognize that they're shedding because they don't have lesions yet. So quite often what normally happens, individuals who have this are aware they have it, and they will, of course, they will not have sexual practices during active exacerbation or when they have genital lesions, but the problem is you could be shedding for some time prior to those lesions and you are contagious, if you want to use the term. So this is known as asymptomatic transmission. This, folks, is why it's all over the place, because people think they're being responsible but could be shedding. Infants born to women with genital herpes may be infected with herpes simplex virus via the birth canal. Can also pass to other regions of the body through direct contact. So when we compare the two, they're genetically and serologically different and produce different symptoms. They both primarily affect the oral mucocutaneous area, so cold sores, mouth sores, and genital areas for genital herpes. The primary infection occurs through a break in the mucous membrane of the mouth, throat, eye, or genitals, or through minor abrasions of the skin. So intercourse in itself tends to do damage to tissues in that area, breaks the skin to some degree, so you can see how it can pass. Initial infection can be asymptomatic. So you may be infected with it and you don't even know it. Local multiplication occurs, then we're resulting in systemic infection and a lifelong latent infection with periodic reactivation. So you get it, you may be asymptomatic, it travels up to that dorsal sensory ganglion, and you don't even know you've had it until something comes along that causes reactivation, and suddenly, oh my God, I got a cold sore. Where the hell did that come from? With the virus entering the peripheral sensory nerves and migration along the axon, it avoids immune detection, hence the reason why it goes that way. So there is no immune response after it starts heading up the sensory axon towards the central nervous system. It's not recognized at all by immune response. Physical or psychological stress can reactivate the virus to go into an exacerbation. So let's do one first. Primary infection. So a primary herpes simplex 1 infection affects the mouth and oral cavity, causing vesicles in the mouth, in the throat, and around the lips. So on the top left and right is a primary infection. And I will disclose to you, I had one of these when I was about 42, 43. Don't know where it came from. I just remembered that the skin started falling off the inside of my cheeks. My gums, I had gingivitis. They were swollen like crazy. My lips swelled up. Went to the doctor like, oh my God, what is wrong with me? And he started chuckling. He was a friend of mine. He goes, you got a primary herpes infection. I'm like, from where? He's like, could be anywhere. Right? It was a herpes 1 infection. So my initial infection was this. So you might have had it as a kid. You didn't even know it. And then it's there. So which means I have a latent form of herpes simplex 1 in my body. Because he told me, he said, oh, you're going to get cold sores now. I'm like, okay, I've never had one. So for whatever reason, maybe I should be touching wood, I don't get reactivation. I don't know why. So I don't get cold sores. Whereas my father did. So obviously he had a primary herpes infection and was continuing to have cold sores. Vesicles typically open to form moist ulcers after several days. The other thing I had that took me to the doctor at the time, I did have systemic symptoms. I had a headache. I had a fever, right? And that skin, I thought it was really sick. And he said it'll be gone in a couple of days. And sure enough, it all disappeared within 3 to 4 days and it was finished. Primary infection, though, can often be asymptomatic. So you don't get any of this, but you've been infected and you don't even realize it. Once you've had that primary, any recurrence of the herpes 1 virus will cause possibly a cold sore, but nowhere, you'll never get into where you have all this inflammation and discomfort and so forth again. These are most commonly, these re-exacerbations or reactivations, they're shorter in duration, usually just around the lips, which we know as cold sores, and they're most commonly induced by stress, fever, sunlight, and infection. Now, it's funny that maybe you would say that your sister gets them in her nose, because for a number of years after I got my primary infection, I started getting lesions in the mucous membranes inside my nose. And I couldn't figure out why, and I started reading about it. I'm like, I bet you instead of cold sores, I get lesions deep inside the mucous membrane in my nasal cavities. Because they do. They bleed. They weep. They're crusty, just like a cold sore. They're sore. Yes? Interesting. I know what. Tomatoes, nightshades, animal products. My partner's vegan, by the way. So are both my daughters. Doesn't saw me. I do like a lot of vegan alternatives. I think they're quite good. Okay, let's leave it at one. We'll do two later. Because two will probably scare the heck out of you. What's that? Well, I like the photos. What's that? The bottom left. So that's how they initially may show before they get released. So you can actually see here in the labia that you do have these type of lesions, right? That are here. For me, the big thing is they look painful as hell, like really painful. Now I will disclose to you. I'll turn this off first. Not me.